crutches. At the Vanguard, ex-Marine Sergeant Ron Kovic was being pushed along the avenue in his wheelchair, his hands linked with those of the paralyzed veterans on his left and right. The six-lane street was bordered on its west side by Indian Creek, a saltwater causeway fashioned with multiple docks and piers, and on the east by massive condominium complexes, where the residents, mostly senior citizens, had come out to watch. The only sounds were those of thudding feet, of horns, of the dull rhythmic rotor beat from distant helicopters. The battalion coordinated its movements with hand signals. Kovic drank from a canteen, slumping in the humidity, the VVAW flag draped behind him. For the convention, the Fontainebleau had been cordoned off with walls of temporary fencing, in front of which more than 500 police guarded the entrances, wearing plastic riot visors and white shirts. Ron Kovic and the last patrol approached them in silence. The hotel guests, police, and even the delegates watching from their yachts were suddenly quiet. The VVAW members gathered in the street at the hotel entrance. One of the leaders shouted through a bullhorn, "We want to come inside!" Someone gasped. Thompson could see the horror in the plastic, shielded eyes of the state troopers. Were they really prepared to attack over 1,000 unarmed American veterans in order to defend a hotel full of martini-sipping, yacht-faring political operatives? Without thinking, Thompson tucked his notebook into his belt and took off his watch. "The first thing to go in a street fight is always your watch," he'd write. "And once you've lost a few, you develop a certain instinct that lets you know when it's time to get the thing off your wrist and in a safe pocket." Just then, at a gap in the chain-link wall, Pete McCloskey, an anti-war Republican representative from California, who as a colonel in Korea had been awarded 2 Purple Hearts, demanded that the police let him speak with the demonstrators. "You can't get in through here," a young cop said to him. "Don't give me that crap," McCloskey shouted. "I'm a member of the Congress of the United States, and if you think you're going to stop me from going in there..." He was sure, like Thompson, that violence was imminent. Finally, he flashed his ID at the police and walked quickly to the VVAW Vanguard. To the veterans and their spokesman, he said, "You've got a reaction by a government that fears you. You got to believe that." Later, he spoke with Kovic, who told him a story about being dumped out of his wheelchair and dragged to jail for protesting in front of Nixon's Los Angeles headquarters. With McCloskey's arrival, things finally calmed down. "We don't even want to go in," the spokesman admitted. "We just want to make them turn us away in front of network TV cameras." Afterward, Thompson wrote, "I have been covering anti-war demonstrations with depressing regularity since the winter of 1964. And I've never seen cops so intimidated by demonstrators as they were in front of the Fontainebleau Hotel on that hot Tuesday afternoon in Miami Beach." It was an expertly executed protest, poignant and haunting and honorable. However, with the current administration, it didn't even register. "If God himself had showed up in Miami and denounced Nixon from the podium," Thompson added, "hired gunsels from the Committee for the Re-election of the President would have quickly had him arrested for disturbing the peace." Later that night, Hunter Thompson spent a few hours roaming the floor of the convention center, his Rolling Stone press pass granting him extensive access. Not that there was all that much to see. "The Nixon celebration was an ugly, low-level trip," he'd write, "that hovered somewhere in that indefinable limbo between dullness and obscenity, like a bad pornographic film." The Republicans were mad at Walter Cronkite for not standing during the national anthem. There was a brief controversy over Representative McCloskey and his anti-war platform, but it was quickly silenced. And without any of the fireworks that had characterized Nelson Rockefeller's appearance 8 years earlier in San Francisco. Thompson didn't plan to stick around for the main event, the roll call that signaled Nixon's official nomination. and around 9 p.m. he ducked into a backstage hallway, hoping to stop in for a few drinks at the Railroad Lounge, a temporary bar, when he realized he'd taken a wrong turn. The hallways were a merciless maze. The rooms were uniform and bright. Eventually, he found himself in a bleak, unrecognizable corridor. From the opposite direction, people were approaching, a great number of them. Suddenly, he was beset upon by nearly 2,000 college-aged individuals. They wore red, white, and blue straw boaters and carried signs that read, "Nixon is the one." Together, they were singing "Nixon Now," the campaign's theme song. Reaching out to find a way to make tomorrow a brighter day, making dreams reality, more than ever, Nixon Now for you and me. Nixon Now, Nixon Now. He's made the difference, he's shown us how. Thompson knew he'd never make it past them. Instead, turning in the opposite direction, he let himself be carried by this young, boisterous crowd. They arrived at an enormous ready room, where dozens of handlers began barking orders about the spontaneous demonstration, scheduled for 10:33 p.m., the moment of the roll call's climax, that all these young men and women would surge enthusiastically out onto the floor to enact. By this point, Thompson figured he might as well see the whole thing through and join the participants, Nixon Youth, he'd dubbed them, in their planned spontaneity. And for the next few minutes, he positioned himself demurely against the back wall, careful to hide his Rolling Stone badge. To his surprise, everyone seemed to be leaving him alone. But there was a commotion. From the main entrance, Ron Rosenbaum, the talented 25-year-old Village Voice journalist, attempting to infiltrate the Nixon Youth crowd so he could write about it himself, burst through the handlers who discovered him and fled toward the far end of the room. "No press allowed," they screamed after him. "You can't stay." Just then, Rosenbaum spied Thompson hiding by the wall. He dashed over. They'd become friends on the campaign trail, and pleaded, "They're trying to kick me out." Hunter Thompson jumped to his feet. "You crazy bastard," he said to Rosenbaum. "You fingered me. Look what you've done." The Nixon Youth handlers saw Thompson's press badge. They started shouting at both of them to leave. Thompson turned on Rosenbaum. "That's right," he snarled. And then to the Nixon Youth handlers, "Get that bastard out of here. No press allowed." Rosenbaum, aghast, fled back into the crowd. In the next moment, Thompson tried to explain to these very upset Republicans that he wasn't really a journalist so much as a political observer, planning out a future candidacy. "Have you ever run for office?" he quickly asked them. "What?" one replied. "What about you? What office did you run for?" Hunter Thompson smiled at this young man. "Sheriff, my friend. I ran for sheriff out in Colorado, and I lost by just a hair, because the liberals put the screws to me." Which was, in a certain sense, true. After that, things seemed to go much better. Begrudgingly, they agreed to let him stay. Until suddenly, someone else pointed out the large blue and white McGovern button Thompson had pinned at his chest. The argument started up again, and long story short, in the wake of another quick-footed parry, they worked out a bargain. Thompson didn't have to leave, so long as he was willing to fit in with everyone else by donning a straw boat hat and carrying a sign, which he was. They gave him a hat and some cardboard and pens. "Garbage men demand equal time," he wrote on the blank white square of paper. Soon it was time. From the rough-voiced handlers, a countdown started up. The 2,000 demonstrators were organized into four groups, many of whom were supplied with bags of balloons. Together, they were funneled onto the floor. This was just after 10:30. And as the balloons fell from the ceiling, signaling Nixon's renomination, they paraded past the delegates to release their own rising helium versions. When Hunter Thompson finally stepped out onto the scene, he was momentarily blinded by the transvertical cascade of bright balloons. Along with everyone else, he circled the speaking podium, shouting a few ironic insults at his old CBS friends in the booth above, John Chancellor, notably. But just then, a new set of chants started up. 4 more years, the thousands of organized Nixon youth were screaming in unison, many of them shoving their way toward the television cameras to curse the biased, unpatriotic members of the media. The chant was growing louder. It wasn't just the Nixon youth. The delegates shouted feverishly, too. 4 more years! A terrifying crescendo. Thompson quickly fled back through the screaming crowd, covering the McGovern button with his elbow. But when he reached the press exit, he was suddenly overcome by an intense wave of déjà vu, the uncanny realization that at another time in his life, he'd found himself crushed beneath the same inexplicable weight of sound bearing down upon him now. But when? He stood at the rim of the arena, trying to figure it out. Then it came to me. Yes, in 1964, at the Goldwater Convention in San Francisco, when poor Barry unloaded that fateful line about extremism and the defense of liberty is no vice, etc. I was on the floor of the Cow Palace when he laid that one on the crowd, and I remember feeling genuinely frightened at the violent reaction it provoked. The Goldwater delegates went completely amok for 15 or 20 minutes. He hadn't even finished the sentence before they were on their feet, cheering wildly. Then, as the human thunder kept building, they mounted their metal chairs and began howling, shaking their fists at Huntley and Brinkley up in the NBC booth. And finally, they began picking up those chairs with both hands and bashing them against chairs other delegates were still standing on. What does it mean to spend a decade trying to fight back against injustice, to work within the democratic system's existing means, its electoral contests, nonviolent opportunities for protest, and investigative possibilities of its free press, only to end up being thoroughly pummeled by Richard Milhouse Nixon and his unabashedly corrupt inner circle? What can one make of a defeat at the hands of a gang of political criminals whose main advantage was that they never bothered to acknowledge limitations like the Constitution and its Bill of Rights? The moral fabric on which the country they're looking to control had been founded. That fall, after a few recuperative weeks in Aspen, Hunter Thompson hit the campaign trail again. It was his 9th month in a row of daily engagement, a schedule as extreme as those of the candidates themselves. During the last week of September, the plan was to cover the Republican side of the contest. Thanks to some pulled strings by Pat Buchanan and by Bob Semple, his old friend who'd become the top political reporter for the New York Times, Thompson was finally granted a White House press pass. It happened unexpectedly. He was back in D.C. when he found out, told by the deputy press secretary, Gerald Warren, to make his way to Edwards Air Force Base, and suddenly he was flying out to California to cover a rare Nixon campaign swing. In Oakland, along with all the other reporters, he was corralled into a small, roped-off press area 200 yards from the runway, and it was from such a remove that he witnessed the stunning choreography of Nixon's emergence from the front ramp of the blue-topped Air Force One. He recognized every gesture, the bust-in youth brigade cheerleaders, the awful lyrics to Nixon Now, the signs and TV cameras, and the president's ghoulish two-handed wave, all of it culminating with the campaign's signature chant, 4 more years. Later, at a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the new BART subway system, he was herded into a hallway where a loudspeaker had been set up for the press to listen to the president's speech. "Jesus," he said to another reporter, "is it always like this?" His colleague laughed. "This is accessible," he replied. Afterward, they traveled to Los Angeles. That night, at the Century Plaza, Nixon hosted a $1,000-a-plate dinner, emceed by Bob Hope, that the press was once again forced to watch on a closed-circuit television feed. Outside the hotel, thousands of anti-war protesters had gathered, including representatives for the VVAW who'd arranged themselves beneath an upside-down version of the American flag. Thompson glared balefully at the TV sets. To Bob Semple, standing next to him now, he said, "They're like slugs on a snail farm." He was talking about the national press. In the face of Nixon's draconian tactics, the lack of basic line-of-sight access, he was disgusted. All presidents battled with the people tasked to report on them. But only someone with truly devastating secrets would seek to limit access to such an absurd extent. Just then, Ron Ziegler, the administration's press secretary, an arrogant 33-year-old punk who trained for his current job by working as a PR man for Disneyland, Thompson called him, appeared in the hallway, walking quickly. Thompson tried to ask him about a misguided McGovern attack on Nixon regarding collective bargaining, a softball question simply meant to start a dialogue. But Ziegler never broke stride. "No," he shouted without looking up. Afterward, Thompson turned to Semple. "Does he ever talk like that to you?" "Yes," the New York Times chief political correspondent said. "Excuse me," Semple added. "I have to get a martini." Later, Hunter Thompson was smoking near one of the hotel's indoor palm trees when Terry McDonnell, a young reporter who'd spoken to Thompson for the first time that evening and who years later would become his close friend, walked up to him. "Fucking sheep," Thompson exclaimed. "We're all sheep." He was wearing sunglasses, the cigarette shifting in his mouth. And to McDonnell, he suddenly looked strikingly, unaccountably sad. For Thompson, the night was shaping up to be another example of the journalistic profession's inherent inadequacy when it came to covering a figure as powerful and ruthless and duplicitous as the current president. More than 100 reporters were in attendance for the campaign event at the Century Plaza, and nearly all of them would arrange the paltry amount of information they'd been granted into insipid next-day write-ups. They all knew, in real time, that they were being fed a false narrative, but none of them seemed to have the time or capacity of insight to take it apart. As a result, they found themselves reinforcing the administration's stage-managed reality. In this sense, the Nixon administration, by manipulating the press's brutal deadline schedule dependence on information, on news, had found an absurdly effective way to promulgate meretriciousness to the general electorate. At the start of October, Nixon's lead had increased to 22 points. For Hunter Thompson, a single week of being tethered to the current president was more than enough. Before switching back to report on the McGovern campaign, its doomed final act, he'd write, "This may be the year when we finally come face to face with ourselves, finally just lay back and say it, that we are really just a nation of 220 million used car salesmen with all the money we need to buy guns, and no qualms at all about killing anybody else in the world who tries to make us uncomfortable. McGovern made some stupid mistakes, but in context, they seem almost frivolous compared to the things Richard Nixon does every day of his life, on purpose, as a matter of policy, and a perfect expression of everything he stands for. That is the one grim truth of this election most likely to come back and haunt us. The options were clearly defined, and it is Nixon himself who represents that dark, venal, and incurably violent side of the American character almost every other country in the world has learned to fear and despise. Our Barbie doll president, with his Barbie doll wife and his box full of Barbie doll children, is also America's answer to the monstrous Mr. Hyde. He speaks for the werewolf in us." As the election approached, Thompson pleaded with Jan Wenner to offer the McGovern campaign free full-page advertisements in the upcoming issues of Rolling Stone, but Wenner refused. Each one would have used up $2,000 worth of revenue space. He spent the first part of October hanging around the new McGovern headquarters on K Street, offering advice and watching Nixon's lead continue to grow. Then he went back out on the campaign trail so he could follow the last act to the candidacy of George McGovern, someone who, after their year together trying to unseat an incumbent they both saw as a singular threat to our constitutional democracy, Thompson would consider for the rest of his lifetime a close friend. But by the start of November, Hunter Thompson had all but given up. He endured the final week of the campaign on the Zoo plane, the chartered United Airlines 727 that ferried the overflow press and network technicians to events. The candidate himself, his staff, and the Maine reporters rode on the Maine 727, the Dakota Queen II. And on this auxiliary one, the usual rules associated with airplane flight were disregarded. There was unlimited booze. The Rolling Stones blared over the intercom speakers. During landings, as many people as possible crammed into the cockpit, watching as the ground rushed up at them through the windows. At takeoff, the network cameramen would unspool their excess film, letting it flow like streamers down through the cabin during the 45-degree ascent. There was dancing and drugs and sex in the restrooms and silly string duels that left the seats crusted with neon filament. Onto the overhead racks, the passengers had taped more than 700 room keys from hotels across the country. In such a setting, Thompson faced the coming election by drinking himself to the point of physical and spiritual collapse. "I no longer have the energy to grind my own teeth," he wrote. "My brain has gone numb from this madness." On the road for nearly a year, barely seeing his wife and son, he'd sacrificed so much. And for what? To watch firsthand as one of the most honorable candidates in presidential history shouted as if into a void about Richard Nixon's unfitness and corruption? About Watergate, a scandal that CBS had brought to national attention in October, but that most of the country still continued to write off as just another example of politics as usual? For Thompson, it was nothing short of an American tragedy, one to which there seemed to be no end. Then, on Tuesday, November 7th, George McGovern lost the presidency in the largest landslide in modern history by 503 electoral and 17,995,488 overall votes, a margin of 23 percentage points. Afterward, Hunter Thompson, with his deadline for the book version of his campaign dispatches looming, was suddenly faced with what seemed an impossible task, trying to explain such an outcome. He did one last piece of reporting, an interview in December with McGovern. They talked about all the things that had come to pass, about Hubert Humphrey and George Wallace and the Eagleton debacle and the shocking November 7th loss. The sheer size of it, about how it could have possibly happened. Thompson, more than once, broke down in tears. At the end of their discussion, when the tape recorder was turned off, he said something that McGovern would never forget. "Did the American people know you? Did they know Nixon as you two really were and decide they wanted Nixon? If they really knew him and really knew you and made that judgment, to hell with this book. I don't think it's even worth publishing. But if they didn't know you as you really were, and didn't know Nixon as he really was, then there's some hope for the future." Afterward, Thompson holed himself up in San Francisco at the Seal Rock Inn, which overlooked the Pacific, to put the book together and provide a post-mortem on the loss. He couldn't do it. After days of revision and retrospective footnotes, he gave up on trying to hammer out that last burst of analysis. Instead, he sat down with his editor from Rolling Stone's Straight Arrow Books, Alan Rinsler, and filled the final section with audio conversations. Rinsler asked the political questions that still needed to be addressed, and Thompson, speaking aloud, replied as best he could. The resulting transcript was placed at the end of the narrative, a capstone to the year he'd just endured. "I was determined," he'd go on to explain in the introduction, to write about a presidential campaign the same way I'd write about anything else, as close to the bone as I could get, and to hell with the consequences. On the whole, the book would stand as his best example of impressionistic journalism, of gonzo, as he called it now. A record of calamity in which the effort he exerted to construct it made his statements all the more authentic. He'd done the work of a beat writer with the insight of a cultural essayist. It was a combination that, when all was said and done, gave the book an elegiac feel. He was watching the Republic fail, and there was nothing he could ultimately do but offer his own fragmented testament to its ruin. In doing so, he also found himself in a unique position to critique the specifically insidious way the Nixon administration had continually manipulated reality to win a second term. By calling them out on their stage management and duplicity and inaccessibility in a manner that the other reporters on the campaign trail each day couldn't or wouldn't do, and by highlighting his own subjectivity from the start, he broke ground as a journalist, as someone whose goal was to evaluate and hold accountable the people in power, a task that, when all was said and done, he took as seriously as democracy itself. In his audio recordings with Rinzler, he concluded, "When you vote for president today, you're talking about giving a man dictatorial power for 4 years. I think it might be better to have the real business of the presidency conducted by a city manager type, a prime minister, somebody who's directly answerable to Congress, rather than a person who moves all his friends into the White House and does whatever he wants for 4 years. The whole framework of the presidency is getting out of hand. It's come to the point where you almost can't run unless you can cause people to salivate and whip on each other with big sticks. You almost have to be a rock star to get the kind of fever you need to survive in American politics." Trading time now for time later. The Watergate burglary, as we've come to understand it today, part of a far-reaching conspiracy perpetrated by the executive branch against its perceived enemies, wouldn't emerge as a full-blown scandal until nearly a year after the botched break-in had taken place. On March 24, 1973, District Court Judge John Sirica, during what was supposed to be a sentencing hearing for James McCord, one of the five burglars who'd been arrested at the scene, instead read aloud to the audience in the courtroom a letter he'd received, one in which McCord claimed that the defendants had all been pressured to keep silent, that the operation involved previously undisclosed individuals, that it wasn't a CIA gig, as had previously been suspected, and that now that he was speaking out, he feared for his safety. "I do believe that retaliatory measures will be taken against me, my family, and my friends." Over the next 2 months, a series of similar revelations suggested the conspiracy's astonishing reach. On April 27th, the head of the FBI, L. Patrick Gray, quit after it came out that he'd destroyed evidence. 3 days later, four of Nixon's senior aides, Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman, Domestic Affairs Advisor John Ehrlichman, Attorney General Richard Kleindienst, and White House Counsel John Dean, all resigned. In response, the Justice Department appointed a special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, to conduct an independent investigation. On May 17th, the Senate Watergate Committee, chaired by North Carolina's Sam Ervin, just an old country lawyer, as he liked to call himself, began its nationally televised investigation into the scandal. In Woody Creek, Hunter Thompson spent the start of the summer in front of the television. Each morning, he'd drag his color set out onto the porch to watch the daily 5-hour broadcast. He was still trying to recover from the extremes of the campaign trail. Since the fall, he and Jan Wenner had been fighting over money. Each felt that the other had taken advantage. And that spring, as they negotiated new terms, he explained to Wenner that he was out of gas. "To push it any further, I think, would be coming pretty close to trying to squeeze blood out of last year's corpse." Thompson could sense that something drastic was happening to his body to his self-identification as a literary writer, most of all to his relationship with the world and the people he cared about. But he also knew that this was part of the price he'd agreed to pay from the start, the outcome of his hard-living bargain that for the past decade, via dexedrin and alcohol, he'd embraced. "At the moment, I feel like I've pushed myself and been pushed just about as far as I can stretch for the time being," he wrote to Winner, adding, "One of the central tenets of my concept of chemical speed is that it is not energy in itself, but merely enables the brain and the body to tap latent natural energy resources, which amounts to willfully trading, on a 2 or 3 to 1 basis, time now for time later." In response, he was trying to come up with a more manageable schedule for his life. The plan was to travel less and take fewer journalistic assignments, which meant breaking his existing contract with Rolling Stone, so he could freelance again for lucrative venues like Playboy. He also wanted to focus on book revenues and advances, as opposed to a steady gig of well-paying reporting assignments. Recently, he'd been looking to plan a conference on new politics with all the major Democratic Party heavies, which Rolling Stone would eventually host in, of all places, Elko, Nevada. There'd also been talk of making a national political run for Colorado's open Senate seat. But he knew better than anyone that a campaign like that would probably finish him off completely. "I look forward to as many months as possible of sloth and unemployment," he wrote his mother in April. Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72 was rush published that spring with a first run of 10,000. But Wenner's printer, which was based out of Reno, improperly inked the copies, and only about 500 were legible, almost all of which were sent out to newspapers and magazines. As a result, the reviews started coming in before the books themselves were available for purchase, a serious marketing fuck-up, especially in this case considering the reception. The best account yet published of what it feels like to be out there in the middle of the American political process, Tom Seligson wrote in a glowing full-page review in the Sunday New York Times, arguing that Thompson, as opposed to Norman Mailer or Theodore White, represented the perfect marriage of an in-depth journalism and a subjectively novelistic style, especially when it came to covering the Nixon administration. "Fear and Loathing lets us understand why the men we elect to the presidency may have needle tracks on their identity." Across the country, in the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, and the New York Post, it was the same. A resounding wave of critical recognition that surpassed anything he'd previously experienced with Hell's Angels or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. But for Hunter Thompson, it represented another missed opportunity. Once again, his effort and skill had failed to translate into money. And as the sales sagged due to printing and distribution issues, his resentment toward Rolling Stone and Jan Wenner deepened. Wenner wanted him to go back to Washington to cover the hearings, but that May and June he hunkered down at Owl Farm and watched the events unfold on TV. Each morning, some new incendiary detail came to light. On the very first day, there were stories about stolen files and perjury, and it was becoming clear that, sooner or later, proof was bound to emerge linking the president himself to the scandal. On June 25, John Wesley Dean III entered the caucus room of the Senate office building just north of the Capitol to testify before the committee. He was 34, a Midwesterner. He'd graduated from Georgetown Law School and was close with the Goldwater family, who'd helped him get a job during the Johnson administration as minority counsel on the House Judiciary Committee. In 1970, he was brought on to Nixon's staff, and over the next 3 years, as the president used the apparatus of the state to attack and silence his critics, he'd been the point man between the Haldeman-Ehrlichman block of the executive branch and departments like the IRS and FBI. However, 2 months earlier, facing the prospect of extensive jail time, Dean had agreed to cooperate with U.S. attorneys and reveal everything he knew. For his testimony that day, he'd cut his blonde hair short. He was wearing a pair of tortoiseshell glasses to make himself look older. Thompson, watching in Woody Creek, wrote, "Dean radiates a certain very narrow kind of authority. Nothing personal, but the kind of nasal, blank-hearted authority you feel in the presence of the taxman or a very polite FBI agent." The former White House counsel spoke with a deliberative cadence, his clauses accruing in an eerily Nabokovian fashion. To one who was in the White House and became somewhat familiar with its inner workings, he said in his opening statement, "The Watergate matter was an inevitable outgrowth of a climate of excessive concern over the political impact of demonstrators, excessive concern over leaks, an insatiable appetite for political intelligence, all coupled with a do-it-yourself White House staff regardless of the law." He referred to a covert intelligence operation run by multiple operatives. He shed light on the Ellsberg and Brookings Institution plots. A full transcript of his testimony was published in the New York Times. His appearance before the Senate committee would stretch out across 5 days. At one point, he described a recent March meeting in which he tried to warn Nixon of the criminal nature of their actions. "I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it." Afterward, Thompson wrote, "If the Irvin Committee lets even half of Dean's testimony stand, Richard Nixon won't be able to give away dollar bills in Times Square on the 4th of July." Throughout the hearings, the central issue could be boiled down to a question that Senator Howard Baker repeatedly posed. What did the president know, and when did he know it? John Dean was the first inner circle witness to step up and answer unequivocally, "Nixon knew it all, and he fucking knew it all along." "Everything Richard Milhouse Nixon ever stood for," Hunter Thompson wrote while watching Dean's testimony, "was going up in smoke right in front of our eyes." He set aside his issues with Jan Wenner. He knew he needed to get to Washington as soon as possible. He arrived in mid-July, the city a steaming basin of thick mid-Atlantic air that never seemed to clear. Rolling Stone got him a front-row press pass to the hearings. On one of his first days there, Monday, July 16th, the senators called a surprise witness, Alexander Butterfield, an assistant to Nixon. Thompson was a few feet away when Butterfield responded to a question from the minority counsel. "I was aware of listening devices, yes, sir." Thompson couldn't believe it. In his notebook, he scribbled, "Butterfield regales room with tales of elaborate taping machine." From this moment on, the scandal would take an entirely new shape, that of a battle between the president and Congress over the possession of this amazing cache. Nixon wired his phone, offices, to record all conversations. "Senators will seek the tapes," the New York Times proclaimed the next day. That week, he also witnessed testimony from H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman. He was struck by the physicality of the hearing room, a sense of smallness, unlike the vast theater it looks on TV. From his up-close vantage point, he found himself gazing for what began to feel like unnatural lengths into the eyes of the committee members. "Interesting," he wrote in his notes, "sitting directly behind witness chair. You can look right at Irvin and catch his facial expressions as if he was looking at me. Nodding, fixed stare, occasional quick notes with yellow pencil." Rolling Stone had flown out Ralph Steadman from London to join him, and the photographer Annie Leibovitz, only 23 at the time, was also on hand for the magazine. Together, the three of them crowded into the old Senate office building for the show. At one point, Steadman, drunk, tripped and spilled a beer all over Senator Sam Irvin, who was on his way to the bathroom. Eventually, Thompson began to find the whole thing tedious. He liked to watch the proceedings on television in a nearby bar, and whenever something dramatic happened, he'd bolt over and join the crowd to witness it live. That week, Thompson drove up to George McGovern's house in Chevy Chase, where the senator was throwing a party to mark the one-year anniversary of his nomination to the Democratic ticket. Over 200 people attended. The staffers, aides, and journalists who'd spent the previous year together covering the campaign. Thompson had been worried that the gathering would be a downer considering how the election had played out, but instead it turned into a loose and festive reunion. In the context of Watergate, McGovern's candidacy was no longer being talked about as a mistake-filled blowout. With reporters Jules Whitcover, Jack Germond, Dick Stout, and others, the conversation turned to trying to unpack the dirty tricks that Nixon had employed in the last election. Which one of the Secret Service men assigned to protect McGovern had been reporting daily to Jeb Magruder at CREEP, Thompson wrote, and which one of the 10 or 12 journalists with access to the innards of George's strategy had been on CREEP's payroll at $1,500 a month. He and McGovern had kept in touch. Recently, he'd sent the senator a copy of the book, as well as a signed copy of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas for his wife, Eleanor. And in addition to the party at the senator's house, they'd also scheduled a dinner together, a chance to catch up in a more intimate setting. A few days later, McGovern picked up Thompson at the Washington Hilton on Connecticut Avenue, and they headed to a local Mexican restaurant on 17th and R Streets. Eleanor joined them along with Stedman and a few others. They talked about Watergate, about literature and marijuana laws, and the mood of the country. There was a guitarist making the rounds between tables, and when Thompson saw him, he turned to Stedman. "You know Masters of War, right?" he said. He was insistent. "Ralph, sing Masters of War for the senator." Stedman borrowed the guitar and started in with the chords. Suddenly, everyone at the table began to belt out Bob Dylan's protest song against Vietnam, singing it for one of the few people within the powerful chambers of the American system who'd been listening from the start. George McGovern received the gesture graciously. That summer, Thompson had written him, "Despite all the foul things I said about your pragmatism, I look back on your campaign as one of the high points in my life and one of the most honest and honorable efforts in the history of politics, including my own, I might add. And that's rarefied air to be fixed in. We had entire different personalities, but we hit it off," McGovern would later say. "He used to tell me I was an honest man, and I don't think he delivered that judgment on very many people. He also said, 'You're the best of the lousy lot,' but I always took that as a compliment." It was a reference to The Great Gatsby, this compliment, to a scene at the end of the book during what would turn out to be the final exchange between the narrator, Nick Carraway, and his enigmatic friend, James Gatz. "We shook hands and I started away. Just before I reached the hedge, I remembered something and turned around. 'They're a rotten crowd,' I shouted across the lawn. 'You're worth the whole damn bunch put together.' I've always been glad I said that. It was the only compliment I ever gave him because I disapproved of him from beginning to end. First he nodded politely, and then his face broke into that radiant and understanding smile, as if we'd been in ecstatic cahoots on that fact all the time." Hunter Thompson got back to Woody Creek in the middle of August. He'd been impressed by the overall coverage of Watergate. There was not a hell of a lot of room for a gonzo journalist to operate in that high-tuned atmosphere. For the first time in memory, the Washington Press Corps was working very close to the peak of its awesome but normally dormant potential. Instead, the role he would carve out for himself during the final year of the Nixon administration would perhaps be best described as that of an essayist. The most pertinent part of his writing on Watergate, narratives that tended to dramatize just how difficult it had become for him to compose anything, consisted of extensive ruminations on Richard Milhouse Nixon's drastic turn of fortune. "What will Nixon do?" he wrote that fall. he quoted a comment the president had recently made. "When I am attacked, it is my instinct to strike back." This was a man, Thompson explained, who'd once been so successful for the same reason he was finally brought low. He kept pushing, 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 and inevitably, he pushed too far. Now, backed into a corner in the battle over the tapes, after October's Saturday night massacre, in which he fired the attorney general and his deputies for refusing to replace the independent prosecutor Archibald Cox, was there any way out of the situation except with a constitutional crisis? At the end of the year, the New York Times contacted Thompson about writing an editorial on Watergate. Fear and Loathing in the Bunker was published on January 1, 1974. In it, he went through possible endgames, from resignation on account of health reasons to a preemptive nuclear strike against China, with the full and formal support of our old ally, Russia. The best-case scenario, which he also laid out, was beginning to seem less and less likely. "All we can really ask of him at this point is a semblance of self-restraint until some way can be found to get rid of him gracefully. This is not a cheerful prospect." In the meantime, the economy was sliding. The energy crisis, precipitated by the Yom Kippur War and subsequent oil embargo by Middle Eastern countries, continued. There'd been inflation and stock market crashes and apocalyptically long gas station lines. "The greedy, fascistic incompetence of Richard Nixon's presidency," he wrote at the end of his op-ed, "will leave scars on the minds and lives of a whole generation, his supporters and political allies no less than his opponents." In the end, the tragedy wasn't just about Nixon, at least in the strictest sense. What was really at stake would be much bigger than the current moment. As he'd written that summer, "the slow-rising central horror of Watergate is not that it might grind down to the reluctant impeachment of a vengeful thug of a president whose entire political career has been a monument of the same kind of cheap shots and treachery he finally got nailed for, but that we might somehow fail to learn something from it." At the end of 1973, Oscar Acosta wrote to Hunter Thompson, "You cocksuckers have been ripping me off for a long time." Recently, he'd been informed, incorrectly, that Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was being optioned as a movie, and now he demanded 20% of the profits. The release he'd signed was only for the book, he argued. "Believe me, man, I am dead serious. It would be better for all if we settled it and forgot it. Besides, you can afford it now." He signed the letter, "Your old ex-friend, Oscar." Earlier that year, they'd spent a weekend together in Mexico, where Acosta had been living on and off. Thompson had traveled there to write a piece on shark hunting for Playboy. But in the time since, Acosta's life had taken a precipitous turn. He'd moved past his Benzedrine habit. Now he was mainlining methadrine. His health was faltering. Just before the holidays, he wrote Thompson again, this time without the threats. Instead, he tried to explain how terrible things had gotten. "I'm blackballed everywhere," he lamented. "In Frisco and L.A., I've lived off food stamps and petty theft. As you know, countercultural legends don't pay off in cash. Despite all messages and nightmares to the contrary, I still am looking to you as my only serious white connection for the big contract." He offered to help with Thompson's proposed Senate campaign. He talked about a political alliance between the Freak Power and the Chicano movement. Once again, he asked for his 20% cut of the film rights. "Deduct my loans from you to me," he added, "and wish me well as I do you." Thompson replied a few days later, "What in the fuck would cause you to ask me for money? After all the insane bullshit you've put me through for the past 2 years? He wasn't in the mood for reconciliation. "The ugly truth, Oscar, is that there never was, and as far as I know, never will be, a fucking penny for the film rights to Vegas." It would prove, in retrospect, to be their final exchange. "I can still make a living by writing, old sport. but all you seem to be able to do is burn your ex-friends. He signed the letter, "Good luck, Whitey." At Thanksgiving, Acosta saw his family for the last time. In January, hospitalized for his stomach ulcer, he wrote a long letter to his son Marco, in which he explained his plans to start a new book, The Rise and Fall of General Z. He also sketched out his last will and testament. When he regained his strength, he left California and headed back down to Mexico. 6 months later, sometime in June 1974, he called Marco and said that he was about to get on a friend's sailboat. He would never be seen or heard from again. In the years since, speculation about his fate would run rampant. There was the initial assumption that he'd been shot and thrown overboard during a drug deal that had gone badly, or the boat had been swept up and wrecked by a storm off the Pacific coast. Or maybe something much more sinister was at play. What if he'd been targeted and assassinated by the American intelligence agencies? They'd been following him nearly a decade, after all, for running guns to Mexican rebels. No one would ever really know for sure. This much was true. Acosta was gone. Your brain to cement. On April 30, 1974, Richard Nixon, hoping to somehow avoid the outcome that was beginning to appear inevitable, released his personal version of the transcripts of the White House recordings relevant to the Watergate break-in, as opposed to the tapes themselves, which the special counsel had subpoenaed. These redactions, featuring extensive, unintelligible, and expletive deleted passages, were immediately questioned and dismissed by nearly everyone, from the press to the politicians to the general public. "One of the darkest documents I ever saw," Hunter Thompson would say about these transcripts. In response, Congress and the Justice Department simply ignored these facsimiles and kept up their pursuit of the tapes themselves. By midsummer, it all appeared to be heading to a showdown at the Supreme Court. The only hope Nixon could muster was that the Democratic-controlled House would jump the gun and impeach him ahead of time, which would provide the opportunity, however slim, to peel off in the Senate the 34 votes necessary to avoid conviction. Once again, Thompson planned to spend part of the summer in Washington, positioning himself beneath its deepening pool of heat and stagnant skies, with the hopes of finally witnessing the downfall of the person who, for more than a decade, had embodied the most dour and corruptible characteristics of the Republic's centuries-old identity. Jan Wenner agreed to fund Thompson's presence there, despite their continuing disputes over money. He'd head to D.C. in July. In the meantime, Rolling Stone had another assignment for him. Recently, the magazine had come into possession of an advance copy of a newly released book of Sigmund Freud's writing, The Cocaine Papers, about the famous Viennese's hands-on studies of the drug. And David Felton, now a senior editor, mailed the book to Woody Creek, along with a large supply of the drug. The plan was for Thompson to write a participatory take on the text, as it were. Cocaine was a substance that Hunter Thompson had in the past avoided. He saw it as an overpriced party drug for dilettantes and celebrities and rich people. And for this assignment, taking it in large quantities for the first time, he found that the only way to articulate his thoughts on the subject was through a series of audio recordings. "It seems to induce a kind of speedy interior reaction with a very sloppy exterior reaction," he noted. "Jesus, I do seem like I've been beaten in the teeth with some kind of mush hammer." He spent more than a week burning through the supply Felton had sent, composing reels of audio in the process, the edited down transcript of which he then sent to Rolling Stone, in place of a written article. It was never published. For the rest of his life, for the next 30 years, he'd use cocaine regularly, substituting this more reactive stimulant for dexedrine, which no longer seemed to help him function in the way it once had. From then on, his editor, David Felton, would later reflect, "He wouldn't do a story unless you included cocaine with the payment. and he dried up and couldn't write. I was there when he had huge fits of screaming because he couldn't write the next sentence. It was very difficult for him. It turns your brain to cement. This switch coincided with what appeared to be a new career path. That year, he'd found that he could make a great deal of money on the college lecture circuit, delivering impromptu monologues and raking in $20,000 fees along the way, which allowed him to keep up the image of a lifestyle he now found himself, for all intents and purposes, trapped beneath. His career would never be the same. Over the next three decades, he'd still write some fascinating short pieces, but in the wake of these two changes, cocaine and fame, he'd never again find the dedication and perspective to render the heart of the American condition, especially within a political context, in the way his more sustained work once had. Years later, Sandy would say, "I do not think he was a great writer. I think he clearly had great potential, both as a writer and a leader. However, he fell dramatically, and a very, very long time ago. Hunter wanted to be a great writer, and he had the genius, the talent, and early on the will and the means. He was horrified by whom he had become, and ashamed, or I really should say, tortured. He knew he had failed. He knew that his writing was absolutely not great. This was part of the torture. And yet, he could never climb back." After Hunter Thompson got back from the presidential campaign trail, Sandy was opening the mail, at the time he was down in Mexico working on his Playboy article, when, in a package from Lucian Truscott IV, the young Village Voice writer who'd also reported on the 1972 conventions, she found a cassette. Attached to it was a note. "It may not be a good idea to let Sandy listen to this tape." It was a recording from an afternoon in New York. Truscott's voice was on it. So was Thompson's. At one point, a young woman could be heard speaking. She said, "Shall I get you another wild turkey, Hunter?" Immediately, from the tone, Sandy knew. They were having an affair. She confronted him, made him promise to break it off. In the end, she assumed falsely that this was his only extramarital relationship. Both of them continued to drink heavily. And when Thompson started to use cocaine regularly, Sandy did too. They began taking the drug together. One night, during an especially brutal comedown, she said to him, "Is this the time when there's only two ways to go? More cocaine or take Thorazine? Is this it?" Thorazine, chlorpromazine, was a strong antipsychotic sedative. Since the 1940s, it had been used mainly to treat schizophrenia. "That's it," Thompson said. "That's where we are." Over the course of the next 4 years, the two of them would separate, get back together, break up again, and then returned to Owl Farm to try and make things work one last time. In 1978, Sandy initiated divorce proceedings. With Juan, who was in his early teens, she finally left Hunter Thompson for good. In May 1974, Republican Congressman Charles Wiggins, one of Nixon's staunchest supporters, tried to contextualize the mushrooming Watergate scandal. "These things go in 50-year cycles," he said, "from Grant to Harding to Nixon." That summer, Hunter Thompson had posted up at the Washington Hilton once again, attending morning news conferences and afternoon hearings, rarely sleeping, as the drama drew to a close. At 11 a.m. on July 24th, a rain-gray Wednesday, unseasonably cool, Chief Justice Warren Burger revealed the Supreme Court's unanimous decision in the United States v. Nixon. The president was ordered to hand over all pertinent tapes. At last, Richard Nixon had no more cards left to play. If he failed to do so, he'd be impeached. And if he complied, well, the truth would be confirmed. Which was exactly what happened. On August 5, the 5 p.m. CBS News announced that a previously undisclosed tape, recorded 6 days after the break-in, proved incontrovertibly that the president had ordered the head of the FBI to stop any and all investigations into the matter. "Call Pat Gray," Nixon had been caught telling Haldeman. "And just say, stay the hell out of this." The smoking gun, as it would become known. The House Judiciary Committee worked to finalize its articles of impeachment. Barry Goldwater, 73 years old and still representing Arizona, paid the president a visit and explained that the Senate was prepared to convict him by a large margin. Representative Wiggins told CBS it was time to plan for the orderly transition of power from Richard Nixon to Gerald Ford. The next day, Hunter Thompson was jolted awake in his Washington Hilton bed around noon by a loud pounding on his door. "Wake up!" Craig Vetter, another Rolling Stone writer, shouted from the hallway. "The whole town's gone crazy. The son of a bitch has caved in. He's quitting." There were rumors that Nixon was about to address a joint session of Congress, that he was planning to give an impromptu speech on all three networks, and that he was actually set to appear at any moment in the briefing room alongside Ron Ziegler. The White House switchboard was completely jammed, something that had never before happened. Thompson and Vetter decided to set up a command post at the Hilton pool, where they'd worked out a deal with a security guard to allow them after-hours access. With a portable TV set and FM radio, they camped out at a table near the lifeguard stand to see out the last few hours of their summer-long death watch. Soon it was official. "I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow," Nixon announced from the Oval Office. The next morning, Hunter Thompson headed down to the pool at dawn. The plan was for him to join up with Annie Leibovitz and document for history the impending departure. In the meantime, after setting up his portable TV, he got in and swam a few laps. Rain scattered the surface of the water. The town suddenly seemed empty, desolate. He climbed out and, exhausted, lay down in the grass. He was listening for the news. Soon it was time for him to change clothes and take a taxi down to the White House, a mile and a half away. Leibovitz was waiting for him. But he never moved. Hunter was back at the hotel, Leibovitz would write in her memoir. Every reporter on the planet was at the White House, and Hunter was in the swimming pool at the Hilton with a battery-powered TV set. Alone in the grass with his portable television, Thompson watched Nixon deliver his farewell address from the East Room. "Always remember," the president said, sobbing openly to his cabinet and staff, "others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself." On a red carpet, he walked to the South Lawn, where the helicopter was waiting. And then Richard Nixon was flying away. For a moment, as Thompson sat there watching the televised departure, the chop of distant rotors indistinguishable from the city's characteristic blare, it was as if a light had gone out of the world. There would not be this kind of mourning anymore, because the main ingredient for that mix was no longer available in Washington. No, even with the pool and the ale and grass and the portable TV set, the morning news will not be the same without the foul specter of Richard Nixon glaring out of the tube. But the war is over now, and he lost. Gone, but not forgotten. Missed, but not mourned. We will not see another one like him for quite a while. He was dishonest to a fault. The truth was not in him. And if it can be said that he resembled any other living animal in this world, it could only have been the hyena. Afterward, like Nixon, Hunter Thompson flew west to California. Wenner had set aside 8 pages for the article on the resignation. Thompson camped out in the Rolling Stone office suite, which was stocked with drugs and booze, in order to meet his rapidly approaching deadline. Which brings us now to a final time-lapsed image. our last glimpse of Hunter S. Thompson before we take our leave of him here. Once again, he's alone in a room. Next to him is a full vial of cocaine. It's empty. It's full. It's empty again. The sun rises and sets. There's darkness. There's light. The blue morning depth of the sky. He hasn't typed a single word. Still, he won't leave his desk. He's been sitting at his typewriter for days, but the page remains blank. The image doesn't change. The deadline comes and goes. He's missed it. Remember, the worst eulogy of all is the one you never get a chance to write for yourself. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's manic 10-year crusade against American fascism. Written by Timothy Denevi. Read by Mark Boyette. Produced by Christine M. Farrell. Directed by Michelle Figueroa, Charles McCrory, and Jared Pinkney. Post-production by Audio Media Production. Freak Kingdom is also available in print and digital formats from Public Affairs, an imprint of Perseus Books, LLC, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Timothy Denevi. Audio production copyright 2018 by Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.